blame people for being fat? Have you been made to feel bad, or have you been discriminated against because you're overweight? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, June 4th. Our guest this hour says all is not fair with the war on obesity, and that women and children, especially lower-income women of color and their children, are being harmed. We will welcome your thoughts and your experiences. Do you think the war on obesity is going too far? Do we unjustly shame and blame and discriminate against those who are overweight? And does this harm fall mostly on women and children? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is April Herndon, an associate professor of English at Winona State University. She's a health writer at psychologytoday.com and the author of Fat Blame: How the War on Obesity Victimizes Women and Children. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks for having me on.
And before we get into your research on how this victimizes women and children, talk a little bit about your own story. You experienced not only fat blame, but thin privilege?
Yes. I come at this, I suppose, from an interesting sort of an angle. About 5 years ago, I weighed almost 300 pounds. I'd always been large. I had a very strong family history of diabetes, and my blood sugar had crept up, and I went to my doctor and said, you know, I've seen my future. My mother now has to use a wheelchair quite regularly because she's had so many problems with her feet as complications from diabetes, and she's always been a very thin woman. And my doctor said, okay, we'll put you on a program where you'll eat as if you already have full-blown diabetes, and we'll see what happens. You might lose 20 or 30 pounds. Turns out I ended up losing the 120 pounds largely by accident, just from getting my blood sugar regulated. And at that point, I had already been writing about this topic, and several people in my life said, are you going to find something new to write about now? And I said, no, I'm actually even more convinced now that this book needs to be written, because I had known before that I had felt discrimination and had experienced discrimination as a large person. But once I became a fairly conventionally embodied thin person, I realized what sort of privilege was there. So, you know, very simple things. For example, just walking into clothing stores and immediately being greeted in positive ways. Whereas, you know, once before, I'll never forget the first time I went into a Victoria's Secret, and this was many, many years ago, when I lived in another state, an employee approached me and said, you know, we don't have anything in here that will fit you.
Oh.
And I was really, you know, dismayed that that was how I was greeted when I came into the store. I find now when I go to see physicians, even if they're not aware of my history, you know, whatever it is I'm actually there for, be it a cold or a foot that hurts, whatever it is, they tend to focus on that rather than actually on my weight. And so my experience from being on both sides of this let me know that, in fact, what I had experienced as a large person was very real. And there is quite a big difference being a thin person in the world and how you're treated. So that just made me want to write the book even more.
And was it just last year or so that the medical community has labeled obesity a disease and is encouraging doctors to talk to patients about their weight? You never found that to be an issue?
Well, you know, before when, you know, I was going to see a doctor and I was larger, you know, certainly that was almost always the focus. Now it's not so much the focus, although I did have a very interesting experience last week, and this is interesting to me in terms of how the goalposts shift and the way that we choose to define obesity and how we frame it and how we talk to people about it. I went in to see my doctor, and, you know, the blood pressure was 102 over 55, the resting pulse was 52, and the nurse said, oh, you know, we only see that in teenagers, that's great. And then she took my height and weight, and as she was entering all of this information into the patient management software that they use now, she said, I have to tell you that by your BMI, you are actually overweight, and I need to ask you if you would like to see a dietitian, and I have to record your answer in the system.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was fascinating.
Yeah, because you are, I mean, I'm bad at math, but you're barely, you know, what, you're only 120-some pounds.
No, I lost 120 pounds. Oh. I mean, you know, technically I am, by those BMI standards, you know, a little overweight. But the interesting thing to me, Joy, about that moment is so much of our discourse about fatness focuses on this idea that it's always volitional, that it can be controlled. And that's how we frame that issue. And we often frame it as an absolute choice for everyone, that people are choosing to be fat. And so when I said to her, no, I don't want to see a dietitian. I already saw a dietitian several years ago, and I'm on an eating program to regulate my blood sugar, and so that needs to stay the same. She was required, before she could leave that screen, to check a box that said, I had refused to see a dietitian. Now, at some level, what that says to someone somewhere who's cataloging all of this information is, we have someone here who is overweight and chose to remain so because she declined an invitation to see a dietitian. And when I left the office, my biggest fear from that wasn't necessarily for me. I mean, I'm a state employee. I have state-based insurance. I mean, I have some layers of protection. But you can imagine that at some point in our society, we might get to a point where someone either loses health coverage for saying, no, I don't want to see a dietitian, or has to pay a higher premium, because at that point, you've been constructed as someone who's choosing to be fat. And I was fascinated by that moment, just that one moment during that visit that let me know that weight really has become, you know, quite a central focus in terms of those medical exams, because all of those other numbers that she had just congratulated me on, that we would also traditionally consider as markers of health, had kind of gone out the window.
Yeah. Well, this is certainly troubling and frustrating for you, this shaming and blaming. Tell us why you have concluded that this war on obesity victimizes women.
Well, one of the most interesting things about what we do now in the war against obesity is that we have a constant conversation in our culture about the causes of it. And for most people now, when they talk about the causes of it, they'll talk about things like food deserts. They'll mention a lack of safe playgrounds. They'll mention our school lunch program struggling in order to meet the nutritional needs of students. But most of the interventions that we actually put into place don't, in fact, operate on those systems. They operate instead at the level of individual bodies because, again, the way the issue is framed is most often as an issue of individual responsibility. And right now, some of the most troubling interventions that we have take place on the bodies of women and children. And historically, this has happened quite a bit. There's always that idea that if you want to stop some sort of a cultural shift, you start with the kids, right? So that the next generation, we have a lot of that conversation about we want the next generation to have more than their parents before. We want the next generation to be healthy. So many of the interventions now are starting early in people's lives. And there's nothing malicious about that intent, certainly. You know, it's a good sort of thing that drives this. People want kids to be healthier. But it does mean that we have women and children who are having all sorts of interventions take place around their body. So, for example, we have children who are being taken out of homes because their obesity is construed as a sign of neglect. And certainly I would hope we can all agree, one, that this is not a viable solution to the obesity epidemic, because we can't possibly have enough foster care. We really believe childhood obesity is in an epidemic proportion. That's not a realistic solution. We just don't have enough foster care to pull all those kids out.
Let me hold you there. There actually, sure. there are documented cases, more than one or two of, even if there are one or two, of a child being pulled out of a home because that child was overweight, and the community welfare agency thought that this amounted to child abuse?
Yes, that's correct. There are several landmark cases in Ohio, New Mexico, New York. These are, you know, cases that we hear about sometimes on the news, but yes, you know, it happens. It's quite well documented. And in fact, in 2011, there was a doctor and lawyer team who published an article in, you know, and it got picked up and published in other journals that basically called for the removal of children from homes. And this was a physician and a lawyer team who were writing this together, calling for the removal of children from homes if their obesity reached a certain level, with the understanding that what that obesity conveyed was a lack of understanding on the parents' part for how to care for their children, that whether or not you want to consider it abuse, certainly it was being framed as a kind of neglect. And, you know, what we know from the children who are pulled out of those homes and from the court records is that many of them don't, in fact, end up being thin, even when they're put into pretty strict weight loss programs. We know from at least one young girl from New Mexico who, actually is old enough now to give interviews based on her experience of having been pulled out of her home when she was 3 or 4. She talks about how that time in her life was incredibly confusing and difficult because she really didn't understand. All she had ever known from her parents was love. And so to be pulled out of that home, she really couldn't understand what had happened, that she was away from her family. And so, you know, we have these kinds of interventions. And you can imagine, of course, the children who are pulled out of homes are not normally children from wealthy homes. These are children who are living in homes where many times it's a single parent who almost always is female. They're working class families, they're families of color, because those are the families who are usually in the state systems and subject to surveillance already. So, you know, as you pointed out, Joy, yes, it's very often child welfare services or someone who notices that a child is heavy, and then that's where the initial inquiry starts. Yeah. And then the children are, you know, usually the families are given some opportunity to try to have the children lose weight, and when they don't, they are sometimes removed from home.
And that is one of the ways women are victimized, too. The children certainly are victimized by being blamed and pulled out of the home. A lot of times we think it's mom's fault.
We do. One of the things that happens pretty frequently in the court cases, and I think in our larger cultural conversations as well, is that you hear a lot these days about, well, if women would just stay home and cook, if mom would just put home-cooked meals on the table, we wouldn't have this obesity epidemic. And that's interesting for several different reasons in terms of how women are framed as being responsible for this. You know, first off, we don't really have solid evidence that if every kid got a home-cooked meal, the obesity epidemic would disappear. It's very unlikely that would be the single cause of anything. I mean, one of the things I usually stress to folks is, you know, all of our social situations, and especially anything involving bodies, like, it's multifactorial. It's very difficult to find one single cause. Those are the kinds of things that are very hard to study. The idea, too, always that everything that gets cooked at home is always better than anything that gets brought in from outside, not necessarily true. And, you know, the other thing that's troubling about this is there seems to be a constant sort of assumption that women are doing a bad job at mothering and that it's always their responsibility to be the one cooking meals. One of the things I did for the book was to survey a lot of advice manuals for the parents of overweight children. And although the advice manuals are always directed at parents, it's mom who's actually talked about within the context of these advice manuals and within the text of the book. And men and fathers are almost completely absent from these discussions. And that's an incredible amount of pressure.
We're going to take a short pause. And when we come back, we will take your calls, your reactions, your experiences. Do you think that the war on obesity victimizes women and children? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with the author of Fat Blame: How the War on Obesity Victimizes Women and Children. And we welcome your questions for April Herndon, who is an associate professor of English at Winona State University. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. What about you? Do you struggle with your weight? Do you sense this fat blame, this shaming game, discrimination? What messages do you get from your doctor or maybe the media about being overweight? We welcome your experiences and we welcome your views on whether you think this war on obesity is primarily hurting women and children. We have a Facebook comment from Krista, who writes, "A battle against women and children, especially women and children who are marginalized via class and race." She is taking from the material from your book that we posted on Facebook. "Is it really only women, children, blacks, and browns who are fat?" April.
Well, the answer to that is no, it's not. And in the book, I certainly don't argue that those are the only people who are fat. What the book looks at is the ways in which the interventions that are now taking place take place on those bodies, because those are seen as the most troubling and as the most likely places to end the obesity epidemic. So, for example, another way in which women are targeted in the war on obesity is this idea that if we can stop women from getting fat in the first place, they will not pass it on to their children. So there's a growing field of research, and there's a lot of controversy around it, and this is in no way, shape, or form cemented yet, or something that we would necessarily consider, you know, absolute scientific fact. But, you know, there's a hot debate about how much weight during a pregnancy and even pre-pregnancy. I mean, we've got some doctors arguing that, you know, from very early in their lives, women should always be thin, because if you spend any amount of time heavy, over-consuming calories, what have you, you end up subjecting your child to the risk of being overweight. And so we actually have a lot of policies being put into place where women will be counseled about their weight from early on. You know, part of what that does is undermine women's abilities to determine their own bodies. It kind of sets them up as containers for a fetus and not very much more. And again, the idea behind it is not necessarily filled with malice. The idea behind that is that here's the best place to stop this. So certainly, you know, what I'm suggesting is not that only women and children who are poor or of color are the only large people in our society. It's just that those are where our efforts are currently really being aimed. They're the ones who have become the target in the war, so to speak.
Yeah. What is it now? They're saying a pregnant woman should only gain like 25 pounds or something like that.
Yeah, they've actually decreased that quite a bit. And, you know, some of those guidelines are very difficult to meet. And part of what you have to, I think, really question and ask yourself is, you know, how will most women ultimately end up keeping their weight down that low? Probably through fairly unhealthy means, right? And so there's a real question there. I'm glad you brought that up. There's a real question of, does this ultimately lead to better health for a woman and her fetus if what women have to do to maintain that weight is in and of itself unhealthy?
Yeah. I know you also talk about the intervention of the bariatric surgeries. How is that, unjustly targeted to women and children, that matter?
Right. The bariatric surgery one, you know, in terms of the women, in terms of it targeting women, that's a little bit of a peripheral issue, and I'll get back to that one. But to sort of focus that one much more on children, one of the things that's happening is we're performing these surgeries, and the guidelines currently say in the U.S., the suggested guidelines are 13 for girls and 15 for boys as ages when these could be performed, with the understanding that those ages, those recommendations come about basically from an understanding that most kids are probably close to their maximum height. Because one of the things that people worry about, and this is a fair worry, is that those surgeries restrict how much food you can take and how much nutrition your body can absorb from that food so severely that it does actually affect growth. And people have to take vitamins and do all sorts of things in order to actually keep their bodies functioning after those surgeries. And so a lot of the justification for doing those surgeries is not just the kids' weight, but how the kids are treated. And so you find in a lot of the medical articles that teasing is one of the reasons that people talk about performing these surgeries, which to me is really wrong-headed. The idea that you have kids who are being teased, and then you frame that as an issue that requires them to change their bodies, to me is one of the moments when we can really see how what we say is a problem is actually not what's being targeted. So, you know, if we think kids get fat because of school lunch programs and sidewalks, instead of operating on those, we're operating on their bodies. And that's part of what I mean about the unfair targeting and how we frame the issue as we understand it as having social causes. I think most of us would understand teasing as a social issue, but yet the way that we continually seem to go about trying to fix these things is to act on those individual bodies. And in this case, we're talking about kids having surgeries that in many cases, a lot of these procedures are irreversible. They'll have them for a lifetime. We don't have good outcome studies, but we're doing those surgeries on those kids' bodies. And in terms of women and their sort of involvement in this, you know, if you're a mother and you've been watching the news and you know that sometimes children are removed from homes because their obesity is considered a sign of neglect, or if you've just been even living with the daily pressure of having people sort of asking you, why is your kid fat? Do you not cook meals at home? you can imagine that as you're trying to make the decision about whether or not for your child to have a surgery, that's an extra layer of pressure that you're facing in terms of what does it mean about me as a mother? You know, what is the best choice for my child? Everything in society tells me to make this child thin. How far do I go to do that? You know, is being a good mother making that choice to give your child a surgery, or is it not giving your child that surgery? It's a difficult decision for a lot of parents to make, and I think because we know women are much more pressured to be seen as the caretakers, they're probably facing a lot more of the burden of that decision-making process.
We are going to check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll return, continuing our conversation with April Herndon, who is an associate professor of English at Winona State University and the author of Fat Blame, How the War on Obesity Victimizes Women and Children. When we come back from our news break, we'll find out what April thinks about First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign to reduce childhood obesity. She's not really a fan, and we'll find out why. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Do you blame a mother if her child is overweight? Has the war on obesity gone too far? Our guest says it has, and the interventions or preventions or cures often victimize women and children. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up now on 6:37. We are talking with the author of Fat Blame, How the War on Obesity Victimizes Women and Children, and we are welcoming your questions for her. We're welcoming your own experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. April Herndon is an associate professor of English at Winona State University and a health writer at psychologytoday.com. Promised that when we came back from news, we would talk about First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign to reduce childhood obesity. Why is it you are not a fan of that campaign, April?
Well, first let me say I'm a Democrat deep in my soul, so this is not a. It pains me a little bit to actually talk about this, but you know, in terms of what I'd like to see happen, I think I have to be critical of it. You know, first just in terms of how it's framed. The title of that program, just the branding of it, Let's Move, it frames it as an individual issue, right? That somehow obesity, you have to, the person must get up and move. And again, if we really think the problem is sidewalks and that sort of thing, there's some obstacles then to a lot of people moving. So there's that. But on a much deeper level, what bothers me about it is I think it's one of those places where we can see laid bare that what we're talking about isn't really obesity. I mean, the things that the program advocates are great, which is that everyone have access to nutritious food, everyone have access to safe playgrounds and be encouraged to move. But the thing is, we know that that's good for all children, regardless of their weight, that thin kids also need access to good nutrition and access to safe playgrounds and an ability to get physical exercise. The one thing we can all agree on, I think, you know, every doctor, whether or not they think that fatness in and of itself is a problem, everybody agrees good food and movement, two of the best ways to keep yourself healthy. But what the program that First Lady Obama has set up really focuses on is this idea that you do those things to lose weight, that we do those things actually because of obesity. And the truth is that's good for all kids. We shouldn't be targeting or focusing on fat children and ending obesity. We should be saying if what we really want is a healthier generation, this is just about giving everyone this, regardless of what their bodies look like on the other side of this. One of my other concerns about it is that even if you look at the website for the campaign, it really emphasizes that childhood obesity is more prevalent in African American and Hispanic communities. And we know demographically that is the case. But one of the troubling parts about that is that there's a way that that can be acknowledged, and we can sort of think through that as a structural issue in terms of issues of economic class or access to food, nutrition, or what have you. But one of my worries is that what ends up happening is that people come to think, you know, okay, so the people in our country who are the fattest, who are dragging us down, who are jeopardizing our national health care, and there's some of that on the website as well, that part of why we have to solve the obesity problem is that we're going to bankrupt our nation if we don't. Part of what ends up happening is that I think there's a real risk of the blame being laid at the feet of families and children who are already marginalized by race and class, you know, which says all over again, you know, we know that you have obstacles to buying the, you know, the certain, the food that we're prescribing. We know that you have obstacles to getting the exercise in. We know all of these things, but we still expect you to do it. And when you don't, we're going to come back again and say, you know, and now we're in a healthcare crisis because you didn't make yourselves thin. And so, you know, again, my concern is, you know, it's two-pronged. It's one, you know, why are we talking about obesity when we're talking about this? This would be good for everyone. And two, when we look at who the campaign is targeting, does that just cause the potential for more problems on down the road, again, with children and families who are already marginalized by race and class?
Yeah, so instead of a war against obesity, you want a war for better health or a war on health? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that I think is really interesting, I'd actually like to see the war rhetoric go away entirely. I actually think that language is very problematic. You know, when you start talking about war, people want an identifiable enemy in some ways, right? So if we look back historically at something like the war on HIV, it's not, you know, a nameless, faceless pathogen that ends up being the target, because that doesn't serve very well. It's sort of an icon for people's anger or righteousness or whatever they're feeling when you start talking about war. So it was gay men who became the target. If we think about the war on poverty, it wasn't structural poverty that sort of became the target in people's minds. It was actually, for the most part, women and poor women of color who became the target in those people's minds. So what I always say is, you know, if we could remove the war rhetoric, that I think would be very helpful. But certainly, yes, Joy, like what I'm looking for is some kind of a campaign that's based on health that doesn't necessarily have weight loss as the goal. In part because, again, you know, there are thin kids, I'm sure, all over our country who need good food and movement. You know, we assume that they're getting those things because of how their bodies look, but I'm willing to bet money that there are plenty of kids in both urban and rural environments who are thin but could still benefit from a country where everyone, regardless of what their body looks like on the other side, is given equal access to food and good, safe neighborhoods and playgrounds and physical education classes and allowed to move freely in the world.
Let's take a call from Jenny in Waukesha. Hello, Jenny.
Good morning. I'm just calling in. This, I guess, is a topic that is very dear to me. I have two boys. My oldest son was always a very, very thick, heavy kid growing up. You know, he was the kid that kids in grade school would make comments about, you know, he's the fat one. And I know that he always struggled with his weight, and the pediatrician through the years that his physicals was always concerned about, you know, do we put him on a diet? You know, and I know that by genetics, my husband was a very husky child. You know, we kept him in sports. He played seasonal sports all year round. And I know at the time I had talked to a dietitian, and she said part of the problem with putting kids on a diet when they're young is typically they know when they're full, and you don't want to turn a kid into a closet eater. So, you know, we just kept up with the good nutrition. We kept him physically active, and he is now 16. He is tall. He's skinny. He eats well. He's very active. He feels good about himself, and I really don't know that we could have done it better any other way. I think putting a kid on a diet when they're young, I mean, I'm sure there's certain boundaries that you have to watch with that, but I think a lot of times it's, you know, just enforcing the healthy lifestyles. You know, felt good about himself. I think he does look back a little bit and feel bad about having all those years being husky, but, you know, yeah. he's gotten to the point that he does feel good about himself.
Right.
So I don't know that, you know, I'm a nurse and I know the good nutrition and we did what we could as parents, but I don't know that it was really anybody's fault.
Right. And it sounds like you didn't necessarily put him on some strict calorie restriction. It just was, did not put her husky boy on a diet, and he's all is well now, April. Your reaction to that story?
You know, I think that there's several like really good and key points here. The first is that it is absolutely true that when we look at studies from food psychologists and dietitians, one of the things that they often say is that putting children on very restrictive diets does lead to problems later on. One, because they unlearn actually their own cues of satiety, right? Because they're not sort of eating until they're full. They're focusing on some sort of arbitrary guidelines that someone gave them, right? Which means they sort of learn to disregard their own internal cues, which is a problem. We also know that food restriction in kids leads to those taboo foods and actually makes them, in some cases, want them more, which can cause some disordered eating late in life. There are a lot of dietitians and food psychologists who, you know, often, you know, caution people against putting children on highly restricted diets. The other thing that's very interesting is this idea that the kid grows up and ends up being socially well-adjusted. We know from all sorts of studies that kids, even kids who have very visual, like facial cranial anomalies, like kids who have cleft palate, all sorts of things that visually people see them, they're treated different because of them. We know that those kids, if they have good support at home and feel loved, they grow up and are quite psychosocially well adjusted. And so that's one of the interesting things, too, about the idea that when kids are being teased, you immediately change their body. Another way to think of that is, no, how do you get those kids good social support, right? How do you train parents to have those conversations with their kids and say, we know you're being teased, but that's okay. That doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you, right? That means there's something wrong with the person who's teasing you. And so these are all good points, I think, made in this. And quite honestly, even if her son had grown up and was still fat, the truth is there are in our world many people who are fat and healthy. Lots of doctors now will acknowledge that you can be large and still be healthy. And there are lots of people who are fat, healthy, and happy because they do have supportive networks in their lives. And so the idea that being fat is somehow a doomsday for anyone, you know, doesn't really pan out if we look. I mean, people do suffer under the discrimination. That's unfortunate. That's unpleasant. But there are ways that you can be a large person and still be happy and healthy in the world.
Thanks to Jenny. Here's Adam on Facebook writes, when the very obese come to my office complaining of problems, apparently he's a physician, he says, I can't even examine them properly sometimes. I can't feel their abdominal organs. I can't hear their heart and lungs. We can't forget how damaging a problem this can be to our society. So I guess getting into huskies, one thing, but, you know, a child that is extremely obese, aren't there very, very serious health consequences to that?
So it's interesting. I think that one of the first things I've sort of heard there is that there are challenges to, as a physician, to examining someone who's very large. And I'm sure that that's actually true, but there are also challenges to examining all kinds of other people in our society. So, for example, you know, women who have very fibrous breast tissue, anyone doing mammograms or doing those breast exams will tell you that women who have what are called complicated breasts, it's very difficult to sort out sometimes what's actually just a benign fibroid tissue from something that needs to be biopsied, right? But yet we don't blame those women. We don't sort of suggest that they need to somehow fix those breasts. And so part of what happens here is that lots of different kinds of patients present challenges to doctors. But somehow, because obesity is framed as being volitional and people think you could just change it in an instant, right? You just wake up one morning and you make the choice to go on a diet and you fix that. Those patients, I think, end up being unfairly penalized in ways that other patients who present challenges may not be, because those challenges aren't seen as being within that patient's control. And I think that's a problem because, again, if you're a physician, if you're someone in the medical field, you know you're going to have patients who are challenging to you. And the important thing to do is to find ways to work around those challenges, because here's the truth. That person may never, for whatever reason, lose weight, but that person still deserves the best possible medical care. You may have to acknowledge that it's difficult to palpate a particular organ or something of that sort, but that person still deserves your best effort, I think.
Let me jump in, because we're past our break time, but when we come back from break, we'll talk a little bit more about this and ask April if this means she condones obesity. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. April Herndon is the author of Fat Blame. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with a guest who says the war on obesity victimizes women and children. And we're finding out how and why from April Herndon, who is the author of Fat Blame. And we are welcoming your input, too. But I know you're asked this question a lot, April. Does all this mean you condone obesity?
I do get asked that question a lot, and I may be mischaracterizing Adam in his question on Facebook, so I apologize if I am, but I think there might be a little undercurrent of that there as well, because what motivates that question, I think, is this, you know, this fear that what's going to happen if we remove the discrimination is that more people are going to get fat, and won't that just be more challenging, and people who are already fat will get even fatter. And I think that fear about more people getting fat is what motivates that question. And I think if we take a little bit of time and we unpack that, that's really wrong-headed thinking, that if we remove discrimination, more people get fat. So no one, for example, would ever think that ending discrimination against people with disabilities means more people will become disabled. If we sort of sub out another category, we can understand the wrong-headed thinking there. People really only think that about fatness because it is framed as an issue of individual choice and volition. You know, basically that people are fat because they choose to eat all kinds of bad food and not exercise, and that everyone's just waiting to do that. And of course, that it's really silly. People are not just waiting to get fat. They're not. And I think if we let that fear continue to drive discrimination, because, you know, if our investment is really in better health for people, there are all kinds of studies that suggest that discrimination is terrible for people's health. I mean, when we look at studies of populations that are already marginalized, we know that discrimination affects people's blood pressure, it affects heart health, it does all sorts of terrible things for people to live under that kind of stress. And plus, if being discriminated against made people thin, we wouldn't have fat people in the U.S. right now, because we have so much data that suggests that fat discrimination exists in housing, employment, health care. There have been several landmark studies that have come out recently that even people who are in the healthcare field who specialize in bariatric surgery, where they're taking care of people who medically would be defined as morbidly obese, even those people express a bias against fat people. And so in spite of all of the discrimination that we already have, people remain fat. So it's not that I'm condoning obesity. What I'm saying is, let's get rid of the discrimination and let's talk about what's sort of driving that fear, which is that more people will get fat.
Tom in Baraboo is with us next. Hello, Tom.
Good morning, Joy. Thank you for taking my call. I have an interesting history. I was thin when I was young until I moved away from home, went to college, discovered cafeterias, a different way of eating and living. I went from my graduation weight in high school of about 160 pounds to about 220 by the time I was 21 years old, and the spiral continued upward. I had my first bariatric surgery at age 40. I'm primarily motivated by health. I had become diabetic, and certainly I suffered from an awful lot of discrimination in my job. I was a professional person, didn't feel good about myself. Created lots of problems. I had gone to 325 pounds. I had to have my suits tailor-made so that I could look acceptable. had problems getting around. Had four children. I was very limited as a dad in my participation in physical activities. So weight really did create some problems. I made the decision to have the bariatric surgery. My first surgery was...
You know, I'm sorry, Tom, we're not going to have time to go into, you know, all details on this, but,
okay.
But your primary point, as we are running out of time, is that being obese was a problem for you, and the bariatric surgery was helpful for you.
Successful.
Yeah.
And I totally disagree with this author in that discrimination should be the focus. I think rather our focus with weight loss, particularly with the young, is diet. There's a new man that has a couple of books out. Jonathan?
I'm sorry, Tom. I know you have lots of good information. There are a lot of different books out, but what about this, April, that we really... You know, like kids today are, they say, a whole lot heavier than they used to be, and this is causing kids, you know, young kids to be diabetic, and we can't wait until the sidewalks are built to do something about that, can we?
Well, that's an excellent question. I actually think maybe we can wait until the sidewalks are built, because the truth is the studies about whether or not weight in and of itself causes diabetes are very mixed. Like, in terms of diabetes and weight, a lot of medical professionals will totally acknowledge that it's a chicken or the egg question. We don't understand if people get heavy and that causes diabetes, or people already have a propensity toward diabetes and that causes weight gain. And so I think one of the most interesting things you just said, Joy, is this idea that a lot of people, I think, have, which is we must do something now. And my thing is, you know, if we think about it from a mechanical perspective, if we had a car and we didn't really understand what was causing it to misfire or not run properly, we wouldn't take it in and just tell the mechanic, just do anything. We would want him to take the time to figure out what was going on and invest our money and our time and our effort in the place where it actually got us the result that we wanted. And I think rather than looking for that quick fix, that really is what we need to do in terms of this problem.
Let's take one last call, Judy in Grays Lake. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thank you for having me on at the last minute. I also disagree with the guest. I think obesity is a major health problem, and although there are isolated incidents of discrimination and, for instance, children being taken out of their homes, I mean, something has to be done, and I'm in my 60s, my early 60s, and I myself have, you know, had some weight problems throughout my life, and the most discriminatory person was myself, because nobody wants to be fat, and most people acknowledge that they're the cause of their obesity. And
Judy, I'm going to jump in, because I know your final point was, what are the solutions to this, April, in less than a minute? What do you want to see happen?
Well, I really think, you know, we don't, in fact, this idea that something has to be done, it really doesn't. And I do think that's driving problematic interventions. In terms of what needs to be done, I think we have to slow things down. We really have to step back and say, if we have an obesity epidemic, what's causing those things? And again, my argument is not that obesity is great or any of those sorts of things. My argument is that the interventions that we're doing now, we know that they don't work. We know that bariatric surgeries, if we look at the outcome studies, people often don't stay thin from those. They require lots of follow-up surgeries. It's not a one-shot deal. We know that kids pulled from home don't end up actually losing a lot of weight. Don't end up.
All right. And I'm sorry, now I'm going to have to jump in here because we are out of time. Thank you so much. April Herndon is the author of Fat Blame. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.